Here on Stolen Lives, we discuss brutal and heartbreaking crimes against children. Themes may include child murder, torture, and sexual, domestic and child abuse. I do try my best to remain respectful for the babies in these stories and leave out unnecessary details that honestly, none of us need to know to understand the frustration of why and how this ever happened. However, if you find any of these themes triggering, this podcast may not be for you. Listener discretion is advised. February 2004, Sarasota, Florida. A car wash camera caught the moment 11-year-old Carly Boucher was taken. The footage was shown on every TV in America. No one could imagine the horror Carly faced leading up to her death, committed by a man who should have never been allowed in the community that day. This is Carly's story.
An innocent 11-year-old girl abducted from Evie's car wash on Bee Ridge Road. It was 6:21 on Super Bowl Sunday.
Surveillance cameras caught a man approaching and leading Carly away. It was February 1st, 2004, and that video is engraved in our minds forever.
The surveillance video made international headlines. For the officers searching for Carly, it changed the case.
Carly Jane Boucher was born March 16, 1992, in Long Island, New York, to parents Susan Shahorafend and Joseph Boucher. Carly spent the first few years of life living on Long Island, before Susan and Joseph separated and ultimately divorced. At this time, Carly moved with her mother to Sarasota, Florida, and with new stepfather, Steve Kengsler. Susan and Joseph appeared to be still really amicable. Carly would speak to him regularly, and he was involved in all the big decisions in his daughter's life. This was truly it takes a village to raise a child, because Carly would spend school vacations staying with extended family on Long Island. This really was the best case scenario, being a child of divorced parents. Carly was happy and loved and nurtured by her entire family. She had so many people behind her, wanting what was best for her. Now, in February 2004, when our story takes place, Carly was in the sixth grade at McIntosh Middle School in Florida. Teachers would later recall Carly having this sunny disposition. She was bright and playful. She had a whole heap of friends. The community Carly lived in was the ideal place to raise a child. It was full of close-knit working-class young families who all looked out for each other. I am talking the type of neighborhood that has street parties. They would go over to each other's homes for barbecues, have conversations over the fence about the latest gossip. Honestly, nothing I'm going to talk about today really had any warnings it was going to happen. Carly was loved, she was doing well at school, and lived in a safe neighborhood. Sunday, February 1st, 2004. Carly was spending a completely ordinary afternoon at her friend's home in Sarasota, Florida. It would be around 6:10 p.m. She set off for a short walk back to her own home. It was Super Bowl Sunday, and she wanted to watch the game with her mother and stepfather. They were having a small party, and she just wanted to be there for it. The walk wasn't all that far, maybe around 1 mile, or just over 1.5 kilometres. And this was a walk she'd made a number of times before. It wasn't like she never went anywhere on her own. She and her friends would walk to each other's homes every weekend and after school. Again, safe neighbourhood, and residents all looked out for each other. This friend's mother even played it safe, and she called Carly's mother Susan to make sure it was all right for the 11-year-old to walk home. Now on this occasion, maybe given the day it was, people would have been drinking and just erring on the side of caution. But Susan said that she would actually prefer it if Carly's stepfather picked her up this time. So Steve went to this friend's house, but by the time he got there, Carly had already left. It was 6:20 p.m. at this stage. It's not clear what exactly happened here, with Susan saying that she wanted Steve to pick up Carly. Look, I don't know. If this was a friend of my youngest who was also 11 years old, I would make it my responsibility to make sure that this happened, that they weren't going anywhere until their parents picked them up. But it is possible that Carly took it upon herself to just walk home anyway. And this mother got distracted and didn't realise until after the fact. It's not clear in my research exactly what had happened. Now, just after Carly left her friend's house, a man approached her. On the CCTV footage that was made available during the early days of the investigation, you can see that this man says a few words to her. We don't know what he said to her, but it's obviously very demanding, giving her orders. He gripped her firmly on the arm and forced the child out of frame of the camera. It is clear that Carly doesn't know this man and doesn't want to go with him, but she wasn't given the choice. Now, while all of this is happening, Carly's stepfather Steve is driving around because obviously he is concerned that she left her friend's house without permission. And Susan entrusted him to go get her, and now he doesn't know where she is. He knows the area, though, and knows which route she would have taken home, but he can't see her anywhere. Steve would have started becoming concerned. He retraced the whole route where she would have walked, but there was absolutely no sign of his stepdaughter anywhere. Now, I've been in this situation. My daughter, who was 12 at the time, would take the bus closest to her home as she could, and I would pick her up and we'd go home together. Well, one day she wasn't at the bus stop. I waited for about half an hour and other buses came and went, but still no child. I tried calling her phone, which was switched off. Long story short, after panic calls to her father and going in and out of local shops, literally crying with worry, her bus was just super, super late, and her phone was out of battery. But in that almost hour, all the worst possible thoughts enter your head. You can't help it. You see it every day on the news, and there are podcasts and documentaries of evil predators preying on children. Now, in the vast majority of times, it has a happy ending like in mine. But unfortunately, and thankfully rarely, the child is gone. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. About an hour after her disappearance, Carly still hadn't returned home. It was clear that Carly wasn't just on her way home or with a friend. This was when Susan reported her daughter missing. Susan told the 911 dispatcher that they couldn't find her and they had called all of her friends and they hadn't seen her either. That they had retraced the route she would have walked home a number of times and there was no sign of her.
911 with the location of the emergency.
My daughter is missing. She's gone. We can't find her anywhere. I've called all her friends.
How old is she?
11.
And when was the last time that she was seen?
It was at 6 o'clock, Jane. Around 6 o'clock.
Now, this is one situation where the police immediately step into action. Investigators are canvassing the area where Carly would have walked from her friend's house to her home. And this continued until 3 a.m. Susan and Steve were asked to stay home just in case Carly showed up or called them. Now, I can't imagine how this all affected them. As the hours ticked by, and police can't be the heroes and bring her immediately back to them. Obviously, they would have been beside themselves with deep, deep panic. And we know those first few hours of a missing child investigation. If they aren't found, the likelihood they're coming home to you, the statistic is extremely low against that being the result. Now, I know we talked about Cleo Smith a few weeks ago, and she was found safe after 18 days, but that is the exception, a rare exception, and we all know this. Regardless, the police are committed, and they continue to search throughout the night into the next morning. They interviewed literally everyone who saw Carly that day. They speak to her friends. Because even at 11, kids are going to tell their friends things that they may not want their parents to know. Maybe there was problems at school, an older boy, bullying, or maybe there was something going on at home. Now, we know none of that is the case in this instance. But the police wanted to make sure that all possible avenues were explored. So the investigators were able to rule out that Carly had run away basically from the get-go. The next step would be trying to work out where Carly went after leaving her friend's house, and the exact moment when she went missing. February 2nd, 2004, 12 p.m. This was when a crucial piece of evidence was found. Police using search bloodhound dogs. And these beautiful, intelligent creatures who can basically sniff out anything, the smallest trace of a scent. They are able to track Carly's scent to Evie's car wash on Bee Ridge Road. At that point, her scent just stopped. Investigators then requested the CCTV footage from the business, from around the back of the car wash at the time Carly would have went missing. There was this hope that this footage would hold all the answers as to where the 11-year-old could have gone. Now, given the scent was picked up there, investigators were expecting to see something. But I could not imagine what went through their minds when they saw what they saw. Never would they expect what the footage was showing them. And it would have just levelled up the urgency in finding Carly. The footage showed a man dressed in what looked similar to a mechanic's uniform. This man saying something seemingly sinister and then grabbing her by the arm. It was clear from looking at Carly's body language that she didn't know this man. It was clear that she doesn't want to go with him as he forces her out of the range of the camera. Now this footage becomes key in moving forward the investigation. They now have a site of the abduction, they have a suspect, and they have a time frame from when she was taken. The CCTV footage showing 6:21 p.m. This footage was immediately released to the media, airing on all the national news broadcasts, hoping someone recognised the man, or at least maybe witnessed something firsthand that could lead them to Carly. An Amber Alert is released because they absolutely want everyone aware of this case, all eyes and ears on the ground. Missing posters are also placed all over the neighbourhood and surrounding towns, family and friends organising their own searches in an attempt to find something, anything to locate Carly. On the morning of February 3rd, 2004, a woman called through a tip to police that she recognised the man from the CCTV footage, that he was a former employee of her husband's mechanic workshop. The husband was interviewed by Detective Vincent Riviera, and he identified the man in the footage as 37-year-old Joseph Smith, even giving the police his home address. But this wouldn't be the only tip investigators received. They received multiple tips, all saying that this guy was 100% Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith was born March 19, 1966 in Pennsylvania. Smith had a troubled and unstable childhood and adolescence. Not that any of that excuses the decisions he makes as an adult. Most people who had difficult childhoods, absent parents, abuse and neglect, etc., myself included, we don't grow up to continue that cycle and we don't commit violent crimes. Many of us in these situations actually work very hard to make changes and to have the support around us to create a difference for future generations. But I think people like Joseph Smith, they are a breed of themselves, and I don't think it would have mattered if they had the most privileged upbringing possible. It wouldn't have made a difference. A monster is sometimes born a monster. From my research, by the time Smith became a teenager, he was never going to be an academic, barely getting by in schooling. He really had no direction in his life, and he started abusing illicit drugs. Smith would commit his first crime, well, the first crime he was caught doing in 1993, and he was arrested for attacking a woman on the street, literally breaking her nose with a motorcycle helmet. For this crime, Smith would plead no contest to aggravated battery, and he served 60 days in jail with 2 years on probation. In 1997, Smith was placed on 1 year's probation on a concealed weapons charge, after he was arrested carrying a 5-inch knife hidden in the waistband of his shorts. And then in 1999, Smith was next arrested for heroin possession, and then he was placed on probation again for 18 months. It honestly had no effect on Smith, though, because a month later, he was arrested on prescription fraud. This charge would be dropped, but I don't think it even matters at this point. It showed that Smith had no intention of turning his life around. He was going to continue to commit crime after crime until he was locked away for good. Next in 2000, Smith was arrested on prescription fraud again, and for this, he was sentenced to 6 months of house arrest, followed by a year's probation. Honestly, by this point, you have to ask yourself if probation is actually having any effect, because time and time again, Smith is getting probation yet being charged with crime shortly after. It was not a deterrent at all for this man. There needs to be some sanity here where there is a realisation that probation isn't working and career criminals like Smith need to be behind bars. 2001, surprise, surprise, but Joseph Smith is arrested again for prescription fraud. And as I mentioned earlier, Smith had a drug problem. And this was most likely the reason we are seeing him being arrested for this over and over. This time he was sentenced to 30 months, but would only serve 16 months of this. He would be released New Year's Day 2003. Only 8 days later, yes, just a week later, Joseph Smith would be found by police passed out in his car with drugs in the passenger seat next to him. He was facing a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. But the judge would determine that the crime wasn't enough to put him in prison. Even though there was that history there was that repetition there. That Smith wasn't making any effort to change his life and make good choices. No, let's just let him run free, that little scallywag. I truly hope my frustration is showing here, because this is really ridiculous. I understand overcrowding in prisons, but this is a repeat offender. Something had to change to make a change. But no. Instead, he was given 3 more years probation. People who knew Joseph Smith described him as a man who was consumed by addiction and making repeated bad choices. That he was often volatile and unpredictable. Smith struggled to maintain steady relationships, friendships, and employment. Now, the man who recognised him on the CCTV footage would later state, quote, "I would never have thought he was capable, but then reading about his history, it was a big pill to swallow," unquote. Now, at the time these tips were coming in of people recognising the men on the CCTV footage, Joseph Smith was living at a rental property near Proctor Road. He was separated from his wife, Tara. But Smith really wanted to reconcile here, so he was trying to fix the issues between him and his wife. Tara and Smith had 2 young daughters together. So obviously a separation wasn't ideal, but we can all understand that. But he wanted to fix things. For a number of days, the entire community had been out searching for the 11-year-old. Everyone was desperately trying to find this little girl. The FBI were involved at this point, and they'd actually asked NASA to use technology that would enhance the quality of the surveillance footage. And while all of this was happening, the footage continued to run on every news channel. February 3rd, 2004, the police arrested Joseph Smith on violation of prior drug offences. He breached his probation, and that's because the prior year, Smith had violated his probation twice. But the authorities had decided for some reason not to remand him. He just got away with it without any consequences. When police first arrived at Smith's home, no one answered the door. Less than an hour later, his sister showed up and agreed to bring her brother out, who was actually inside. He was just refusing to answer the door. When he finally came out to talk to investigators, he was obviously questioned about his activities on the day of Carly's disappearance. Smith gave his whereabouts from that day, and obviously he claimed he was nowhere near the car wash. Now, one of the detectives interviewing Smith asked for permission to examine his tattoos, because these were visible on the CCTV footage. He was taken aback, questioning why they needed to. But then on the flip side, if you're an innocent person, why would that be an issue? But I can also understand why there would be some nervousness there, because tattoos aren't particularly unique. I mean, I got one of my tattoos from the internet and it's in the same placement as that photo. But then the investigators pushed it further, like they wanted to search Smith's room and his car, and he signed a written consent form allowing them to search these things. But in his room, police found mechanic uniforms in his closet, which again matches the CCTV footage of the men abducting Carly. But there was nothing found tying him to the kidnapping. However, what investigators did find was drug paraphernalia in his car. There was a spoon on the front seat, and it appeared that the spoon had been used to melt or burn narcotics. And any drug use was a direct violation of his parole conditions. And then in the trunk of the car, there was a cardboard box with another spoon inside with similar residue on it. So this all allowed for Smith to be arrested on the parole violation. Now, obviously, they wanted to question him about Carly, because they literally have him on CCTV leading her away. He basically refused to answer any of their questions, but asked if it was okay for him to smoke. Now, there was some confusion because why they waited for Smith's lawyer. Investigators interviewed the owner of the rental property that Smith had been living at, and she gave him an alibi for the time Carly disappeared. She said that Smith was on the phone to his estranged partner at 6:30 p.m. So this threw the investigators for a loop, because they dead set thought they had their guy. Everything matched Smith to the guy in the CCTV footage, but then searching his car and room, there just wasn't anything to suggest a child abduction had taken place. And here was someone confirming that he was home alone the entire time. So Smith was cleared of suspicion, but he remained in custody because of that parole violation. Now, the husband of the woman the investigators had interviewed earlier that day, who owned the house Smith rented the room from, he went into the police station. And he totally debunked his wife's recollection of events. He said that this phone call must have happened another day. He knew for a fact Smith wasn't home, because he borrowed the man's yellow station wagon on the afternoon of February 1st, the day Carly went missing, and Smith didn't return with the vehicle until the following morning. The man also said he believed Smith was definitely the man in the CCTV footage as well. But this man turned over his yellow station wagon for forensic examination. For the next 2 days, Smith flat out refused to cooperate. But then on February 5th, 2004, he finally admitted where Carly's body could be found. This would be through a confession to Smith's brother, John. John was being questioned by authorities. They were trying to get more insight into the type of person Smith was. Now, while the brothers weren't particularly close, Smith contacted John February 1st, 2004 at around 8 p.m. And this was the day Carly was abducted. Just after she was abducted, actually. John basically told Smith that he really didn't want to talk to him. But when John and his girlfriend saw the news of the abduction and saw the CCTV footage, he immediately knew that this was his brother, because Smith had distinctive walk due to back surgery. Now, despite John telling Smith he didn't want to talk to him, Smith apparently came to John's house that night at around 11 p.m. He was under the influence of drugs. John didn't want any part of it, and he told him to basically fuck off. John told the investigators all of this and that he wanted to help them find out what happened to Carly. That he agreed to talk to Smith and to try to get a confession out of him, because nothing else was working at this point. So the meeting was arranged, and the men's mother was also in attendance. She would leave after around 45 minutes, but John stayed and the two men kept talking for another half hour. But after that, John told the investigators Smith told him nothing either. Well, that's what they thought at the time. Because that night John called the investigators and he confronted them, that they obviously heard what they wanted to know, John thinking that they had bugged his phone. But they didn't. They had no idea what went on during their conversation. But the fact John was calling them told them that obviously Smith told John something that could be important. So the investigators along with two FBI agents went to John's house. And he admitted that Smith confessed that Carly was dead, that Joseph Smith had murdered the girl. In his confession, Smith confessed to having, quote-unquote, rough sex with Carly before strangling her. Now, the fact that he referred to what he did in that manner is absolutely disgusting to me. This wasn't sex, it was rape. He raped this 11-year-old girl and he murdered her. Smith is an absolute monstrous animal. Smith also told his brother where they could find her body. John ended up directing the investigators to the grounds of a church off Proctor Road in Sarasota, just a few miles from the car wash where Carly was abducted. While they were at the church, John received another call from Smith. He went into detail on the location of the body, and that's exactly where investigators would find little Carly. 11-year-old Carly Brusher was found lying on her back in a field behind the church. She was naked from the waist down, if not for a sock still on her right foot. Her right leg was outstretched, and her left leg was curled under her body. She had a deep ligature mark on her neck, consistent with strangulation. Investigators also found that Smith disposed of her backpack and clothing in different trash cans nearby. Carly's body was taken for an autopsy, and it was confirmed what everyone had feared, confirming what Smith had confessed to, that Carly had been sexually violated and murdered. The medical examiner determined that Carly likely died on the night of her abduction, that ligature strangulation was the cause of death. The ligature on her neck was consistent with a shoelace being used for the strangulation. There were also ligature marks on her wrists, meaning that she had been bound. There were bruises on the inside of her thigh and also on the shin of her right leg, all indicative of blunt force trauma. The bruises likely due to be because Carly put up a fight against Smith. This sweet little girl fought for her life. There were abrasions on her body, which indicated she'd been dragged to the place where her body was found, including semen on the back of her shirt that was later confirmed to be a match to Joseph Smith. After this point, any conversation Smith had with his brother or mother were recorded, February 9th, 2004. During a conversation between Smith and his mother, she actually has the gall of saying that he just needed to say it was all an accident and everyone would understand. Like, what the actual fuck is wrong with these people? Smith claiming he was on cocaine at the time and he just lost control. I'm sorry, but drug use is an excuse to rape and murder a child. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. February 20th, 2004. Joseph Smith was charged by a grand jury with first-degree murder, kidnapping, and capital sexual battery. He was then transferred from the Sarasota County Jail to the Manatee County Jail, and this is where he would be during the pre-trial hearings, where Smith would plead not guilty. Let's just think about that for a second. He pled not guilty. Not guilty despite telling investigators where to find Carly, despite his DNA being all over this little girl, despite him being on CCTV literally abducting her. What was he really thinking during this? How in what world was he thinking he was going to get away with this? Now, the prosecution basically argued around the evidence that was cut and dry tying Carly's murder to Joseph Smith. The car wash surveillance that was absolutely damning. That Smith was in the possession of a yellow station wagon that was linked to the abduction, because hairs and fibres belonging to Carly were later found in this vehicle. The jailhouse confessions between Smith and his brother. The prosecution arguing there was no other logical result here, that based on undeniable evidence, Smith had abducted Carly for the sole purpose of raping and murdering her. The defence argued that the surveillance video was grainy and unclear at best. The defence argued that it could be anyone who looked like their client, dressed like their client, driving the same car as their client. The defence also questioned the DNA evidence, which is crazy, because the DNA conclusively linked Joseph Smith to Carly. The defence also tried to play the sympathy card for his past, Smith's long history of drug addiction and mental health struggles, about his troubled upbringing. Not that any of that matters in the grand scheme of things, because Smith was of sound mind. He didn't have this huge psychotic break. He didn't have a history of experiencing blackouts or anything like that. He knew what he was doing when he took Carly. April 19th, 2005. A really strange incident occurs when a cryptic jailhouse letter is intercepted. Smith is writing to his brother, and it's seemingly written in code. Now, it is very common for correspondence to be vetted, because obviously sometimes criminals aren't the smartest, and they will confess to things in these letters they otherwise wouldn't. But occasionally, the authorities are one step ahead of these criminals. They picked up on the code, and this wasn't going to fly. The letter is sent to a cryptanalyst, and he translates the code to the following. I wish I had something juicy to say. The backpack and clothes went to four different dumpsters. I left it out in the open. I dragged the body to where it was found. Destroy this after deciphering it and show up. Now, the prosecutors use this coded letter as even more evidence of a confession of guilt, and also confirms he was responsible for moving and hiding the little girl's body. Now, the defence said that nothing that was said in these letters is important, and it was just quote-unquote coded ramblings. And while this is true to an extent, it doesn't give us anything new, and it's only vague statements to the fact. But what it does do is solidify the prosecution's case. November 7th, 2005 would be the commencement of the criminal trial. The prosecution puts forth in their opening statement that Smith was a man who watched and waited, and when he saw his opportunity, he took a child off the street in broad daylight, that he killed her to cover his tracks. They also presented the extensive evidence they had, including forensic DNA and witness testimonies. They presented another letter written by Smith, but this time to another inmate. This letter expressed a desire for violence on his brother and requested violence upon another inmate. Smith's defense presented 19 mitigation witnesses, including friends, family, and acquaintances, all speaking on his behalf, how friendly and helpful he was to people who knew him. But that really means nothing. I'm sure the most heinous of killers are nice to someone sometimes. They also said that Smith loved animals, that Smith had a good relationship with his children, and that they apparently loved him. But again, where's the proof of that? His children weren't testifying on their father's behalf, so who was really to know? The defense spoke about Smith abusing drugs from a young age and how he became an addict, how he tried to become sober but kept relapsing, that Smith suffered from chronic back pain, and that's how he became an addict to prescription painkillers, but that he wanted to change his way, as any true addict has said at least once. The defense said that Smith's life began to unravel after he discovered the body of his best friend after a drug overdose. Now, I'm not sure how any of this has to do with him abducting, raping, and murdering a child, and then disposing of her body. That since he was incarcerated, he hadn't been a subject to any disciplinary actions and hadn't engaged in any violent acts. Hang on a moment, but what about the letter where he was wishing violence upon his brother and another inmate? But the defense wanted it known that since his incarceration, Smith had sought spiritual counseling. Now, I'm sorry, that doesn't absolve someone from punishment due to committing a horrific crime. Justice still needs to be served for the victim and her family. Joseph Smith didn't testify in his own defense, because honestly, there really isn't any defense against what he had done. And he just wouldn't have come across well to the jury. December 1st, 2005. Joseph Smith was obviously found guilty with a jury recommending a death sentence. Smith only then spoke to the court, quote, "After a little time went by, I'd called my wife and I asked her to come home. But on February 1st, I found out that she didn't want me. I lost my business, my family, and my self-control was really coming apart fast. I just wanted to die on that day, so I went out, got a bunch of heroin and cocaine, and began injecting it hoping I would overdose. I was so high. I've never experienced a high like that. It was different than any other time. I think I mixed it with something else. I want you to know that I take full responsibility for my crimes. I don't know how this all happened. I was very angry at myself and very high. I knew that getting high was wrong, but I couldn't stop. I'm not trying to make excuses for what happened, but I really don't remember much about anything on that day after around 4 p.m. Unquote. He doesn't remember. How convenient. But you remember enough to hide her body and dispose of her clothing and bag. We know you remember that because you wrote it in code to your brother. You aren't taking full responsibility for your actions because you're just making excuses. What a disgusting evil man. March 15, 2006. Joseph Smith received his sentence before Judge Thomas Gallen. The aggravating factors being he was on probation, and the murder was committed during sexual battery and kidnapping. He was also found guilty of avoiding arrest. The crime was premeditated, and the age of the victim. She was only 11 years old. Now, the judge addressed Smith directly, quote, "Any one of the aggravating factors outweighs mitigation," unquote. At that point, Joseph Smith was formally sentenced to death by lethal injection for the murder and two life sentences for the other crimes of sexual battery and kidnapping. Now, for years, Smith remained on death row. There is an automatic appeal process that is attached to a death sentence. His first appeal ran between 2006 and 2008 with the Florida Supreme Court, arguing claims of trial error, that Smith's Sixth Amendment rights were violated. Because the FBI supervisor who testified did not personally conduct the bench testing of DNA samples regarding the semen found on Carly's shirt. The defence also objected to medical examiner's testimony that litigation strangulation is highly associated with sexual battery. Now, the court did agree that the statement was scientifically unsupported, but found the error harmless, because overwhelmingly other evidence proved sexual battery in this murder. The defence argued the court wrongly refused to excuse biased jurors. Now, this is because one of the jurors had a daughter Carly's age. Now, I'm not sure how this would mean that the juror would be biased. I mean, if you're going down that route, you need to exclude any parent. Because I mean, for example, I had a daughter Carly's age at one point in the past, and a new parent will have a child Carly's age at some point in the future. I don't see how this is relevant, unless that one juror had her child abducted, raped, and murdered. Now, the defence also objected to the omission of graphic photos of Carly's decomposed body, which is always baffling when the defence does this. These photographs were a real example of what happened to Carly and where she was found. In October 2019, Joseph Smith's convictions of first-degree murder, kidnapping, sexual battery were all upheld. Between 2010 and 2012, Smith's defence team appealed again, using the same arguments as with the previous appeal. At this stage, they aren't trying to get the guilty verdict reversed. It's more about getting that death sentence off the table. But again, they were unsuccessful. And then in January 2016, the US Supreme Court ruled Florida's death penalty law unconstitutional because judges, not juries, made the critical decision to impose death. And this meant in October 2016, Florida's highest court ruled that death sentences must be based on a unanimous jury finding aggravating factors and a unanimous recommendation of death. But Smith's jury was a ruling of 10-2 in favour of death. So what that meant was he wasn't actually going to get the death sentence. In 2017, a Sarasota judge vacated Smith's death penalty because that 2005 jury was not unanimous. For his conviction of sexual battery and kidnapping, they obviously remained the same. And that meant the life sentence without the possibility of parole remained in place. But then in March 2021, the Florida Attorney General's office conceded that Smith was entitled to a new sentencing hearing. And what this meant, he could either receive life with the possibility of parole or the way up to death, if the jury was unanimous. But this hearing would never happen. And the reason for that is, July 27, 2023, at the age of 55, while waiting for the new penalty trial, Joseph Smith died in prison. So he kind of did get the death penalty in the end. He never saw freedom again, and I appreciate that. His cause of death was never released. Apparently it was natural causes. But I have seen other unofficial reports that he died of liver cancer. Following Joseph Smith's death in custody, the state attorney's office released a statement, quote, "While nothing can bring back Carly, we are grateful that her family, her friends, and the entire Sarasota community will not have to endure any further court proceedings to bring Smith to justice," unquote. Carly's father would say, "It hurts me, but I can look at it, that she's in a better place where he can't hurt her again. I'm so grateful that God gave me 11 wonderful years with a very special angel." He also said that the system had found his family by dragging out the case over decades, which is completely understandable. This whole situation is beyond traumatic. The family would end up creating a garden near where Carly's body was found, in her honour, to make this more of a beautiful place than one of horror. On the day of the official opening, Carly's father Joseph actually flew in from New York to be there. Quote, "It means a lot. It means everything. Carly is a beautiful girl, and she needs to have this legacy with a beautiful garden, which it currently is." Unquote. Carly's obituary read, "Carly was a spirited and vibrant young girl, beloved by her family and friends. Carly's family would like to remember her as the joyful and energetic girl she was. While her life was cut short far too soon, her memory will live on in the hearts of all of those who knew her."
I want her legacy, her memory to live on, and I want it to be kind of like an awareness thing, you know, for parents to take their kids here and teach them, you know, what can happen.
Both of her parents obviously have been deeply affected by the loss of their daughter. Carly's father, Joseph, told CNN he had begun drinking heavily. He even considered taking his own life. Sadly, Carly's mother, Susan, died in 2017. She was only 47 years old. Susan died of a drug overdose. One of her close friends said in a news interview, quote, "Susan was an interesting lady, one I really liked, one hiding behind her drug addiction." Carly's death was something impossible for Susan to recover from. This was clearly one of the biggest blows imaginable in her life. This story is just one tragedy after another, all coming back to one horrible, horrible evil monster who destroyed an entire family. If you have your own thoughts and theories on the story we discussed today, or any stories we talk about here on Stolen Lives, please search Stolen Lives Podcast on Facebook, like the page so you don't miss an episode, and join the Stolen Lives discussion group to talk about your thoughts and theories. You can also talk to us on Instagram, Stolen Lives Podcast. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you share this episode on your social media of choice, and subscribe and leave a positive review on your podcast app. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Ali. Hosting and production was also by me, Ali. Music is by Mayu.